Welcome back to Insurance Insights, a financial reporting podcast where we unpack the latest statutory, accounting, regulatory, and actuarial developments from the NAIC. I'm your host, Sean Egan, an audit partner in our insurance practice. In our last episode, we discussed several key topics that were still under deliberation at the NAIC. Today, we're thrilled to tell you about the outcomes of those discussions now that the NAIC's fall meeting has concluded. And if that did not capture your interest, we will also touch on some new topics that are being discussed. Joining me once again is Olga Roberts, Managing Director in the Department of Professional Practice, who's been tracking these developments every step of the way. Olga, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Sean. It's an exciting time. The fall meeting provided us with conclusions to some of the topics and issues that have been discussed over the last couple of years, and also set the stage for the next wave of changes that may be significant to insurers.
In our last conversation, the big cliffhanger was the proposed guidance on risk transfer for combination reinsurance contracts. There was a lot of debate. Where did the NAIC finally land on this?
It was certainly the headline topic, and I am happy to report we have a final answer. The NAIC officially adopted the revisions to SSAP number 61. As we discussed in our last episode, the core of the guidance is that reinsurance contracts with interdependent features, including combination of coinsurance and YRT contracts with combined experienced refunds, or with provisions that do not allow the ceding entity to independently recapture individual contracts, now have to be evaluated in the aggregate to determine if they pass risk transfer.
Yes. And if I recall, one of the key sticking points was the effective date and how to handle existing contracts. What was the final decision on that?
Sean, you're absolutely right. This is a crucial part for implementation. The guidance is effective immediately for any new or newly amended contracts. For all existing contracts, insurers have until December 31, 2026 to comply. Another important point is that the regulators specify that for these existing agreements, any accounting changes resulting from this clarification will be treated as change in accounting principle under SSAP number 3.
So no grandfathering, but a transition period is provided. It sounds like regulators acknowledge for some insurers, this change may have a significant impact.
Exactly. In discussion before the vote to adopt this guidance, they encouraged insurers to work directly with their domiciliary regulators to discuss their specific circumstances. Specifically, if the use of permitted practices may be appropriate. They emphasized the need for transparency and maintaining the integrity of financial solvency assessments and consumer protection.
Excellent clarification. I wanted to ask one additional question on this topic. We talked a lot about accounting impacts, but is there anything our listeners need to consider from the tax perspective?
Sean, I'm glad you asked. For those insurers that may no longer pass risk transfer under the new requirements, not only could there be impact to surplus, but there could also be consequences from the tax perspective, because if the contract does not pass risk transfer for statutory accounting, it will most likely not pass risk transfer for tax purposes, impacting the reserve deduction. Insurers should consult with their tax professionals to evaluate the extent of this impact.
This is really important consideration. Thank you for giving us that perspective. The takeaway here is that as insurers are working through implementation of this clarification, they can't forget about tax. Let's move on to another topic we covered, investments. We talked about the NAIC's push for more transparency. The proposal for new disclosures on private placement securities was a big part of that. Has that been adopted as well?
Yes, it has. This was another key initiative that crossed the finish line. The NEAC adopted the new guidance, which will require much more granular disclosure on private placement investments.
Can you remind our listeners what those new disclosures will entail?
Certainly. Insurers will now need to categorize and disclose their private placement holdings into three buckets. First, those that are publicly registered. Second, those under SEC Rule 144A. And third, other private placements like those under Regulation D. For each of these categories, insurers will need to provide aggregate data, including the book-adjusted carrying value, the fair value, with specific breakdown of how much of these private placement investments are determined under Level 2 versus Level 3, and the total amounts of deferred or paid-in-kind interest. It also requires disclosure of the values of securities supported by private letter ratings. This is a significant step towards providing regulators with deeper visibility into these portfolios.
And what's the timeline for implementing these new investment disclosures?
Similar to the risk transfer guidance for existing contracts, the effective date for private placement disclosures is December 31, 2026.
While we're on the topic of adopted guidance, were there any other notable accounting changes from the fall meeting?
One other item worth mentioning is the elimination of the investment subsidiary concept from the annual statement instructions. As we discussed last time, this concept is not in the accounting guidance. So this change aligns the annual statement with the SSAPs. However, it could have an impact on RBC for some insurers. This change is also effective December 31, 2026.
That's great. A lot of finality there. Now let's pivot from what has been adopted to the topics that are still being discussed and new topics that have been introduced. In our last episode, we talked a lot about IMR. What's the latest on that topic?
There has definitely been progress on the permanent solution to IMR. The Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group has now exposed two proposals. The first is a new statutory accounting concept called the IMR Proof of Reinvestment that deals with the ability to defer negative IMR.
A proof of reinvestment? That sounds interesting. How would that work?
It's a requirement designed to validate that the insurer is investing the proceeds from sales that generated losses into higher yielding investments. To defer a negative IMR balance, an insurer would have to pass two new tests. The first is the reinvestment test that verifies that the cost of fixed income investments purchased is greater than the proceeds from sales plus investable premium. The second is the weighted average yield test. This test validates that the yield on the newly acquired investments is higher than the yield on the investments that were sold. If an insurer fails these tests, any additional realized losses can't be deferred through IMR and would be categorized as an immediate capital loss and surplus.
That makes sense. So insurers will really need to demonstrate not just that they're reinvesting, but that they're actually improving their portfolio yields with these new purchases. What was the other IMR proposal?
The second proposal deals with how IMR impacts reinsurance collateral. Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group exposed revisions to SSAP number 61 that would require what they call an asymmetrical treatment. This means a ceding insurer would have to increase the collateral requirement for any net positive IMR that is derecognized in the reinsurance transaction, but they would be prohibited from decreasing the collateral requirement for any derecognized net negative IMR.
This sounds like a conservative approach.
It is, and it was a point of discussion. Interested parties have been advocating for a symmetrical approach. The current exposure does request comments on whether a symmetrical approach should be considered. So the final word isn't written yet. I expect that both of these proposals will be further discussed at the spring meeting in March.
Olga, let's shift our focus on some of the new proposals that were exposed by the Statutory Accounting Working Group that may be of interest to our listeners. Some of the proposals seem to be clarifying some fundamental accounting topics around commitments and contingencies and equity method investments. Let's start with commitments and contingencies. It looks like the Statutory Accounting Working Group is proposing a major overhaul of the disclosures. What's the driving force behind this?
Sean, you're correct. There is definitely a focus on disclosure. But more than that, the proposed revisions would add a definition for commitments and contingent commitments. The regulators commented that the current disclosure requirements are unclear, incomplete, and are scattered across different SSAPs. The goal of this project is to create a single comprehensive framework so that anyone reading the financial statements can get a complete picture of an insurer's potential off-balance sheet obligations and other contingencies.
So the intent there is to consolidate disclosures and clarify. However, what I'm hearing is that there may have broader implications than just disclosures, since the proposal would create a new definition.
Sean, that's absolutely correct. While consolidating and clarifying disclosure is a significant part of the proposal, introducing a new definition could certainly have wider implications for how commitments and contingencies are reported. That said, I want to emphasize that we're still in very early stages of this process. Nothing has been finalized yet, and I anticipate there will be a lot of discussion and feedback from the industry on this topic at the upcoming meetings.
Let's move to one more accounting topic, a proposal to review equity method investments under SSAP number 48. What's the story here?
This proposal is a little more of what I'll call exploratory. This isn't a proposal for new rule, but rather a proposal to review several concepts within SSAP number 48. The Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group has identified a number of areas where they believe the guidance is either unclear or is not being applied consistently across the industry. Here, they've identified these issues and are asking for feedback.
What are some of the specific points of confusion they are trying to address?
There are several. A big one is timing for recognizing changes in the value of equity method investments. For example, the exposure is asking for comments about potential changes to guidance about recording value changes for an investee before audited financial statements are available, and then recording changes or true-ups when those financial statements are provided. The proposal floats the idea of adding new electronic column to track the date of the last audited financial statements and the audited equity value of the investee.
I know we talked a lot about regulators looking for transparency on our last episode. It sounds like this is another area where they are seeking this transparency. What other areas do they want to discuss?
Another one is goodwill. The proposal raises questions about how goodwill from acquisition of equity method investments is being handled, especially negative goodwill when the investment is acquired at a discount, and also if additional disclosures are needed. In addition to goodwill and timing of measurement of equity method investments, the exposure asks questions about negative investment income, inconsistent use of related party codes, and clarifying what is meant by date originally acquired.
It seems like this has the potential to have broad changes to existing guidance. Definitely a topic our listeners may want to be more familiar with and follow going forward. What are the next steps here?
Exactly. The proposal is in a very early stage of the process, so we really don't know what will be decided and which specific changes to SSAP number 48 will be proposed. But I expect there will be some healthy discussion on this. Hopefully, we will know more at the spring meeting this March.
Ongoing feedback and active engagement will be important on this topic. It also looks like there's a new development for derivatives used for asset liability management. What's happening there?
That's right, Sean. This is a significant development. Currently, an issue paper and a new SSAP are being drafted to address derivatives used for asset liability management. This would be for interest rate hedging derivatives that do not qualify for hedge accounting under existing rules in SSAP number 86 or SSAP number 108, but are still crucial to the insurer's asset liability management.
That sounds like it fills an important gap. Insurers use derivatives for macro hedging all the time. What would this new guidance entail?
The proposal would allow a form of macro hedging, where an insurer can use portfolio of derivatives to hedge an interest rate risk for a large portfolio of assets and liabilities, even their entire book of business. To use this new accounting, an insurer would need approval from its domiciliary regulator and a certification from a financial officer that the strategy meets the definition of a clearly defined hedging strategy and is being used in the insurer's day-to-day risk management.
And how would these derivatives be accounted for? I understand there was a couple of options on the table.
Correct. The two approaches were considered: an amortized cost method and a fair value method. The amortized cost proposal would require insurers to report these hedging instruments at amortized cost. The fair value approach would involve more complexity, with fair value changes flowing through deferred assets and liabilities. The issue paper and the new SSAP being drafted will include the amortized cost method.
Why the preference for the amortized cost method?
There are a few key reasons. The first, it has operational advantages and aligns well with how the underlying assets and liabilities being hedged are already reported. This also mirrors the approach used for highly effective hedges in SSAP number 86, so it's consistent. Lastly, it avoids volatility of recording fair value changes in surplus, which could create inconsistencies with how amounts are used in other important assessments, like the cash flow testing and principles-based reserving. The goal is to have this new guidance effective January 1st, 2027.
Thanks, Olga. We talked about a lot of big accounting topics. Not that those are not enough, but I'll ask anyway. Is there anything else you are seeing from an accounting perspective that may be on the horizon?
Glad you asked. Yes, there is one more topic I wanted to mention. There is currently a proposal at the Macroprudential Working Group to add new disclosures in the annual statement for funding agreements that back funding agreement backed notes, or FABNs. For our listeners that may not be familiar with these, FABNs are debt instruments issued by a special purpose vehicle, which is in turn backed by a funding agreement from an insurer. Right now, there aren't specific disclosures for FABNs, and regulators have expressed that this lack of disclosure limits their ability to monitor their risk in the growing market.
So the regulators are, again, looking for more transparency. What specific information would insurers need to disclose under this proposal?
The proposal would require a good deal more granularity. Insurers would need to disclose funding agreements denominated in foreign currencies that support foreign currency FABNs, funding agreements that support repurchase agreements, all other funding agreements that support FABNs, and whether any of them back puttable FABNs. It would also require a breakdown of the funding agreement amounts by maturity timeframe.
What are the next steps here? Do we have a sense of timing of when these disclosures may be required?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, right now, this proposal at the macroprudential working group, if it gets adopted at that level, the macroprudential working group will send it to the blanks working group that will consider these changes for the annual statement and the statutory accounting principles working group that will consider changes to SSAP number 52 that covers deposit type contracts. As for timing, the regulators said that their goal is to have these disclosures be effective for 2026 year end.
It sounds like another important step toward enhancing regulatory oversight and ensuring market stability. Olga, we've talked a lot about accounting, but I know there are also a number of actuarial topics being discussed as well. So let's pivot to that.
Sean, you are right. The actuarial space has been very active. There are two topics I wanted to specifically mention today. An update on VM22 and discussion about reinvestment guardrails. As a reminder, VM22 introduces principles-based reserving for non-variable annuities that has been adopted and will be effective January 1st, 2026, with a three-year implementation period, becoming mandatory for new non-variable annuity contracts on January 1st, 2029. At the fall meeting, the Life Actuarial Task Force discussed a number of what I'll call day two topics around VM22, such as approach for aggregation, treatment of settlement options, and application of VM22 to deposit type contracts. There are currently proposals out for exposure on approaches for these items. However, what I think is the more important topic and the one we touched on in our previous discussion is the retrospective application of VM22. The update here is that we now have an exposure with questions about retrospective application of VM22 to in-force policies. The regulators laid out several possible approaches, ranging from mandatory application with certain exceptions to fully optional application. And they're seeking feedback. Some of the questions include how far back it should apply and whether there should be materiality thresholds. This is an important issue for annuity writers to follow.
That's a great summary. You also mentioned reinvestment guardrails. Can you tell us what the headlines are on that topic?
Yes, this is another hot topic. The first big discussion is around reinvestment guardrails in VM22 specific to pension risk transfer or PRT business. The Life Actuarial Task Force exposed a framework to modify the reinvestment guardrail requirements specifically for pension risk transfer. The framework considerations included background about the size and nature of pension risk transfer transactions and the key points about why PRT is different from other annuity products. It also included a potential solution that would better reflect actual investment while maintaining an appropriate level of conservatism by prescribing reinvestment guardrail spreads and defaults.
If I'm hearing you correctly, the regulators are viewing pension risk transfer differently than other business in the scope of VM22.
Yes and no. Some regulators were definitely of the view that it is different. However, there were others that had concerns about modifying reinvestment guardrails only for this specific business. They said that PRT business really does not have anything actuarially specific that would not apply to other product types. Generally, regulators expressed interest in continuing conversations on this topic and stated more information is needed.
You said that application for PRT business was only one of the topics being discussed related to reinvestment guardrails. Is there another?
Yes, and it is about creating consistency. Life Actuarial Task Force also exposed a proposal to align their reinvestment guardrails across the different sections of the valuation manual. So VM20, VM21, and now VM22. The Life Actuarial Task Force said the guardrails adopted for VM22 was intended to be a compromise between the existing VM20 and VM21, but it didn't always produce the intended effect. So they've developed a new standardized credit quality blend for the guardrail.
What is the new proposed blend?
The proposal sets the blend at 5% Treasury securities, 15% in assets with a PBR credit rating equivalent to a AA, 40% at an equivalent to a single A, and the final 40% at a BBB equivalent. The goal is to have one consistent benchmark across all reserving methodologies.
Olga, this has been an incredibly helpful overview. It's clear that even after adoption, these actuarial standards are living documents with a lot of moving parts. Thank you for clarifying these developments for us. As we wrap up, I wanted to touch on one last topic, and that is the activities of the RBC Model Governance Task Force. This task force was formed about a year ago, and it seems like they have been working on some important fundamental issues related to RBC.
That's a perfect way to frame it, Sean. This task force is taking a step back to establish a clear governance framework for RBC. Their work is centered on two key actions from their recent meetings. First, they formally adopted a set of principles for RBC. Second, and this is where things have been discussed quite a bit, they've considered revising the preamble to RBC formulas.
Let's start with the principles that were adopted. What is the core message the task force is trying to send?
The first principle, and the one that generally was discussed the most, is the primary purpose of RBC. the task force agreed that it is to identify potentially weakly capitalized insurers. As we talked about on our last episode, there was a lot of discussion about whether the purpose should be broader than that, since RBC is used by a wider group of stakeholders. Although the adopted principles acknowledge that RBC may be used for other things, it also states that these uses must not distort its primary purpose. The other principles that support this state that RBC should be based on the idea of equal capital for equal risk, only consider factors that impact solvency, and be transparent in how it is updated.
So, a clear declaration that RBC is, first and foremost, a tool for regulators. You mentioned a robust discussion about the preamble. What's being proposed there?
Yes, there was a lot of comment letters submitted on this topic. Here, the regulators were concerned that RBC is being used widely in ways it was never designed for, specifically as a tool to rank, rate, or compare insurers. To address this, they proposed to revise a preamble to the RBC formulas to include a discussion about the limited use of RBC, including limiting public disclosures, and the risks of relying on RBC for purposes that it's not designed for. The reaction from both industry as well as consumer representatives was one of significant concern. Commenters argued that the proposed changes would dramatically reduce transparency for investors, policyholders, and other stakeholders who have relied on public RBC data for years. They pointed out that this proposal even conflicts with other regulations that require public disclosure of RBC-related information. While they agree that using RBC as a simple ranking tool is not appropriate, they argued that the data has many valid non-ranking uses of RBC data by companies for risk management and by rating agencies and other stakeholders for assessing financial health. The big fear they raise is that if public access to reliable RBC data is restricted or discouraged, stakeholders will simply turn to less reliable alternative metrics, which doesn't benefit anyone, not the public and not the regulators. They recommended more targeted edits rather than this broad change.
It sounds like there's some tension between the intended use and real-world application. Where does that leave us? What are the next steps?
For now, the discussion continues. This is definitely a topic that I think our listeners would be interested in following.
Olga, once again, we've covered a lot of important topics. We now have more clarity on major topics like risk transfer. We've gotten a clear view of the next set of challenges with IMR and what is on the horizon from both accounting, actuarial, and regulator perspectives. Olga, as we close, what are your final thoughts for our listeners?
My main takeaway is that while some projects have concluded, the pace of change is not slowing down, and we haven't even touched on AI yet. The NAIC has put forth several complex and impactful proposals. It is crucial for insurers to analyze which of these proposals may be important to them and how they could impact reporting in upcoming periods. As always, stay informed and stay engaged. And also, remember, we are here to help, so don't be shy about reaching out to your favorite KPMG professionals.
Absolutely. That's great advice. Thanks again for joining us, Olga, and for sharing your invaluable insights.
My pleasure, Sean.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to Insurance Insights, a financial reporting podcast. We'll be back next quarter to unpack the next round of developments.